Okay, now we can begin. Well, we've been working our way through Acts, and we left off last week in chapter 4. So we're going to pick it up in chapter 4, verse 32, and go right on into chapter 5, because there really, in my opinion, shouldn't be a chapter break right there. So we'll start in Acts chapter 4, verse 32. And the congregation of those who believed were of one heart and soul. And not one of them claimed that anything belonging to him was his own, but all things were common property to them. And with great power the apostles were giving testimony to the resurrection of the Lord Yeshua, and abundant grace was upon them all. For there was not a needy person among them, for all who were owners of land or houses would sell them and bring the proceeds of the sales and lay them at the apostles' feet, and they'd be distributed to each as any had need. And like I said a couple or 3 weeks ago, this is not socialism. This is just the opposite. Socialism is theft, period. All right? There's no getting around that. Socialism is theft. What it says is what's yours is ours. What this is not that. This is generosity. It says what is mine is yours. You know, when there's theft or when there's giving, there's a transfer of property. And just because there's a transfer of property does not mean it's the same thing. I can transfer my property to you by giving it to you, or you holding a gun to my head and taking it from me. One is a righteous act, the other is sin. So let's never confuse this. And I've heard people argue, well, see, the early church, they were socialist. No, not hardly. No. It says, now Joseph, in verse 36, a Levite of Cyprian birth, who is also called Barnabas by the apostles, which translated means son of encouragement, and who owned a tract of land, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. But a man named Ananias with his wife Sapphira sold a piece of property and kept back some of the price for himself with his wife's full knowledge. And bringing a portion of it, he laid it at the apostles' feet. Now, that's okay that he brought a portion, but as you read this, you realize that he brought part of the price but told them he brought all of it. Okay? There's nothing wrong with bringing a part of it. And he said, listen, I sold the property. I'm keeping half because there's some things they do, but I'm taking the other half and giving it to you. No problem. But when he sells it, gives part of the money, claiming that it's all the money, sounds like a small white lie, doesn't it? Doesn't seem like that big a deal. But it was a big deal. Verse 3, but Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back some of the price of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not under your control? Why is it that you have conceived this deed in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God. And as he heard these words, Ananias fell down and breathed his last, and great fear came over all who heard of it. The young men got up, covered him up, and after carrying him out, they buried him. Now there elapsed an interval of about 3 hours, and his wife came in, not knowing what had happened. And Peter responded to her, tell me whether you sold the land for such and such a price. She said, yes, that was the price. Then Peter said to her, why is it that you have agreed together to put the Spirit of the Lord to the test? Behold, the feet of those who have buried your husband are at the door, and they will carry you out as well. And immediately she fell at his feet and breathed her last. And the young men came in and found her dead, and they carried her out and buried her beside her husband. And great fear came over the whole assembly and over all who heard of these things. So, as we get into this chapter, I'm going to take a very strange route, and I want you to trust me that though we're going to go back to Genesis 1, we will wind back up here in Acts chapter 5. But you know, everything in the scriptures is in Genesis. And everything is really there in the first chapter. You know, just like a seed holds all the DNA for a tree or an animal, whatever, the entire DNA of the scriptures, the entire plan is all there in a compact microscopic form in Genesis. And so it's important to go back there, especially today as we go into this. Now, you may not understand why I'm doing this at first, but I promise you, you stick with me, we'll get to where we're going. You'll see why we took the route we did. In Genesis 1, we see the act of creation. I call this creating the stage. Creating the world was not the most important thing on God's mind. The play that would be played out in the world was the most important thing. And I've shared before, you know, if some great playwright has made this incredible play, it is necessary to make a place where it can be played out. And after the play has made its run and it's done, you don't need the stage anymore. But you have to create the stage, the props, the place. And once that's done, now you can get to the real thing it was created for. So when God created the world, he was creating a stage. He's creating a place upon which his play, his story, could be lived out. Now, when God works, he works in a very balanced way, and I'm always stressing the importance of balance as we study the scriptures, because truth out of balance is heresy. There's not one heresy out there, not one false religion out there that doesn't have some truth in it. But remember, truth always comes in a left and a right. It always comes in pairs. It's like the psalmist says in Psalm 61, "One thing God spoke, two things I heard." In other words, when God, the one God, the unified God, when he speaks into this world, because this world is split into physical and spiritual, it comes into us as stereo. Some comes in through the left and some through the right, but we better get both channels or we're going to miss half, at least, of what God is saying. So even in creation, you have the 6 days of creation. First day, light. Second day, firmament. Third day, dry land and vegetation. And all these 3 days, you'll notice, are days of separation. The first day, he separates light from darkness. Second day, he separates the waters above from the waters below. Third day, he brings forth the dry land. He separates the dry land from the oceans and rivers. Because order is always brought through separation. I mean, it's just as basic as you cleaning the basement. I got to clean my workshop this week. So I take the sawdust, it goes here. The hand tools, they go on the pegs there. The power tools, they go on the shelves. The scrap wood goes over here. I separate things out where they belong, and when I do, there's order. In verse 1, the world's a very disordered place. But by the end of day 3, order. The socks are in the sock drawer. You know, the dirty clothes are in the hamper. It's all good. Then on days 4, 5, and 6, he begins to fill these things and create vessels for these things. On day 1, he separated light from darkness, but on day 4, he creates a sun, moon, and stars. These are the vessels for the light, you see. On day 2, he separated the waters above from the waters below, created the firmament in between. But on day 5, its corresponding day, he makes the fish for the waters below, the birds for the waters above, the clouds, the air. Day 3, he brings forth the dry land and the vegetation. And on the 6th day, he brings forth the animals to live on the land, and he also creates man, who is going to be the steward of the vegetation and the animals, and he's going to tend the garden. You see how it works? So each day has its partner. But then there's this 7th day, the Sabbath. What's its partner? What is the partner for the Sabbath today? What's its corresponding created work? Well, we have to go to the next book of the Bible, to Exodus, to find that. And I don't believe in coincidences, but isn't it interesting that this week we just happen to be looking at the 10 words, the giving of the 10 commandments in Parsha Yitro in Exodus chapter 20. Where God's presence descends down on the mountain, and the mountain shakes, and there's the smoke and the fire and the sound of the shofar, and the people see the sounds. And wow, what a day that was. Because on this day, God is now producing the script. He's saying, now this is what you do in my world. This is how you engage the props I've made. This is how you live out your life. This is the role you play as my people. Now, an interesting thing to notice, and the rabbis comment on this, when you look at Genesis in Hebrew, the very first word of the very first verse, the very first letter of the first word of the Bible is the letter Bet. And those of you who know the alphabet, you know Bet is the second letter of the alphabet. It's letter 2, like our letter B. And so the sages say, well, this is the beginning of everything. Shouldn't the Bible start with the letter Aleph, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet? But when you come down to where God gives the Ten Commandments, when you come to that, it begins with Anochi Adonai Elohecha. I am the Lord your God. And guess what the Ten Commandments start with? The letter Aleph. And this is why they say more important than the creation, which starts with the second letter of the alphabet, is the giving of the Torah, which starts with the first letter of the alphabet, because the Torah is the script. The world is just the stage. It's secondary. And so God starts the giving of his Torah with the letter Aleph when he speaks his commandments. And when you look at the Ten Commandments, they also follow the same pattern. The Torah is very specific that when the commandments were given, they were given on two tablets of stone. God could have written small and put them all on one. He could have broken them up into three. He could have done it however he wanted. He put them on two because, again, everything is in balance. Everything corresponds. And so that's what happens here. You have the first five commandments on one tablet, the other five on the other tablet. Why? They correspond to each other. Another interesting thing that connects creation with the Ten Commandments, or they're not actually called Ten Commandments, they're called the Ezra Devarim, the Ten Words, the Ten Words. An interesting thing is if you study the rabbinic literature, it says that when God created the world in Genesis chapter 1, that 10 times it says in that chapter, Vayomer Elohim, and God said. But if you go and read chapter 1, you'll find that that phrase, and God said, is only found 9 times, not 10. And they say, well, he actually spoke 10 times. Because in the very first verse, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, he had to have spoken for that to take place. So the first time he spoke, it just doesn't tell us that he spoke, it's inferred that he spoke. So there were 10 times God said, and God said. And then we have the 10 words. And we see that same pattern repeated here. Because of these 10 words, 9 of them are commandments. Don't put any other gods before him, no idolatry. Don't take God's name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day. Honor parents. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't lie. Don't covet. But that first word is not a commandment. Here is the first of the 10 words. Exodus 20, verse 2. I am Adonai your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Period. Now, I know in Christianity, in Protestantism, they order the commandments a certain way. In Catholicism, they order them a different way. They take the one about idolatry and they cleverly tuck it in with one of the others so it doesn't stand by itself. And they split one of the others in two so you still wind up with 10. It's kind of clever what they do. But you have to understand that from ancient times, and has always been numbered this way in Judaism, the first word is not a commandment. It is simply a statement of what God has accomplished. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, period. So the first commandment is not really a commandment. It's simply a statement of who God is, and you must have faith in that. You must believe that, because the next 9 are based on faith in that first one. So the 10 statements that created the world, the first one's not, it doesn't actually say, and God said. And of the 10 words, the first one's not really a commandment. The other 9 are. Again, you see the patterns the balance, how everything in God's Word rhymes. You must always attune your ear as you study the Scriptures to find the rhyming truth, the thing that comes alongside to bring balance to God's Word. If you miss that, you've got the Word out of balance, and it's cumbersome. It doesn't work quite right. So let's take a look at these, and what we'll notice is that the first commandment and the sixth commandment align with each other, the second with the seventh, and so on. And it's pretty neat how this works. So the first word, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And then the sixth word, we'll just go ahead and call it the sixth commandment, says, you shall not murder. How do these align with one another? Well, the Word tells us that God made us in His image after His likeness. So every human being is a picture, usually, as we were praying earlier, is a very flawed and marred picture, but it's nevertheless an image of God Himself. And when you murder someone, you have destroyed the image of His Creator. You can't say, I love my wife, and then every time you walk by her picture, you spit on it. If you love God, you must treat His image with respect. And God has placed His image all over the world in the form of every human being. And this is why John says over in 1 John 4:20, if anyone says, I love God, and he hates his brother, and remember, all murder comes out of hatred, and he hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. No, I always contend that the two great commandments, you know, remember they asked Yeshua, Rabbi, what's the greatest commandment? He said, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And then he said, and the second's like to it. See, again, Yeshua is saying, to answer your question, there have to be two parts. You know, it's got to be this balance. He says, the second's like unto it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Upon this hang all the Torah and all the prophets. There's something very important here. You can only love God to the degree you love others. Because the only way to truly express love to God is by loving His image where you see it. People say, I want to serve God. You know, there's no way to serve God directly. I mean, you can pray, but how do you serve God directly? How do you do anything for God? The only way you can ever do anything for Him is to do it for your neighbor. There's no other way I know of to serve Him. So people say they love God, they're growing close to God, and yet they don't have time for their brothers and sisters. They do not invest in their brothers and sisters. They avoid fellowship with the brothers and sisters. I got news for that person. They don't love God either. Whatever it is, kind of God they think they love in their head, it's not the God of the Word. It just isn't. So they go together. All right? The second commandment, it reads like this. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image of any or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, that is in the earth beneath, or is in the water under the earth. Now, with that said, we have to understand the context of that. It doesn't mean that sculpture is sin. And if you have in your garden, you have some sculptures of a frog or a gnome or a birds or whatever, it doesn't mean that's sin. In fact, later on, when God gives the instructions to the tabernacle, you find carvings in there, you find embroidery in there of animals and of cherubim and different things. Later, when God gives David the plan for the first temple, Solomon's temple, there were even more carvings in there. Carvings of oxen, carvings of angels, carvings of lions, carvings of all kinds of things. God's not anti-art. God is anti-idolatry. So when he says this, the context is you do not make these things to worship them. You just don't do that. And it goes on and says, you shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, Adonai your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You see, idolatry is a form of hatred towards God. That's an important thing to grab hold of. So, the corresponding commandment, number 7, is do not commit adultery. Now, that was pretty obvious, because as you read the scriptures, all through the prophets, when the people of Israel would go after a foreign god or after idolatry, what does God call that? Spiritual adultery. Because these are his covenant people. Just like a husband and wife, they come into a covenant together. Marriage is a covenant. God had made a covenant with the people of Israel. And when they leave service to their covenant God and go after a foreign God, that is spiritual adultery. They're cheating on the one they're in covenant with. You follow? So that's very obvious how that fits together. God's name. The third commandment says, you shall not take the name of Adonai your God in vain, for Adonai will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. And the eighth commandment, the corresponding one, is you shall not steal. How do these fit together? There's a profound insight in this. I remember Bill Gothard years ago hearing him say this, and it stuck in my mind when I started studying the word from more of a rabbinic perspective, a Hebraic perspective. Bill Gothard's words jumped out at me, because he said every time you use God's name in vain, you are robbing him of his glory. I remember that so well. This is why when you hear someone use God's name in a way that's uplifting and true, it's like God gets glory. But when they use his name in a curse or in just an offhand way, they're taking his glory from him because they're dragging his name in the dirt. And you know, this applies to anything. This applies to anything. You take anything in your life that's precious. You watch how you use that word or how others use the word for that thing. You know, when I hear marriage denigrated, it's taking this glorious, glorious thing that God's created and dragging it down to dirt, robbing it of its glory, making it dirty. But when you hear marriage spoken of in truth, it lifts it up and puts it in the place where it should be. So when you misuse things, you rob them of their glory. This is one of the reasons why we do not try to pronounce God's four-letter name, Yud, He, Vav, He. We don't know how it's pronounced, and we believe that we should be very careful to avoid pronouncing it. We know that Messiah avoided pronouncing it, and he would use what are called evasive pronouns. So instead of saying God's name, he would use the word God, or he would use the word heaven, and he would use the word Father. He would use other pronouns to avoid pronouncing God's name. And people say, well, shouldn't we be lifting up the name of God? Yeah, you do that by not saying his name, but by living his name. You pronounce his name not with your lips, but with your lives. Because a name is the essence of the person himself. And I find that people who are always saying God's name over and over, every sentence has got his name in it, I find their lives do not give much glory to him. They take his name and they make it common. They make it as common as the word Walmart or anything else. It just becomes a thing. But when we avoid pronouncing his name, we actually lift it up. We're making it so holy and lifting it up, giving it such honor that we know the name, but we simply don't put it on our lips. We pronounce it through our lives. And then the fourth commandment, the Sabbath day. It says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord, your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days Adonai made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore, Adonai blessed the seventh day and made it holy. And of course, all of us know if, you know, if we've been raised in Christianity, we all know that that commandment's been done away with and replaced with a commandment to tithe. So, I'm sorry. I'm bad. We're taught that this commandment's done away with. We're taught, well, Yeshua came along and said, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. Okay, he's the Lord of the Sabbath, and so he did away with the Sabbath, which makes him the Lord of nothing now. It doesn't make sense. And the thing is, Christianity actually does not teach that the Sabbath has been done away with. Just a lot of poor teaching has done that. Let me just read you a few quotes. And I'm going to pick different denominations. Here is the handbook from the Anglican/Episcopal Church. Bishop Seymour. He wrote a book called Why We Keep Sunday. But in the book, he says, we have made the change from the seventh day to the first day, from Saturday to Sunday, on the authority of the one holy Catholic Church. Notice he does not say, based on the Bible. Baptist. This is from Dr. Edward T. Hiscox, a paper read before the New York Ministers Conference in 1893. And this is basically foundational Baptist understanding. He says, there was and is a commandment to keep holy the Sabbath day. But that Sabbath day was not Sunday. It will be said, however, with some show of triumph, that the Sabbath was transferred from the seventh to the first day of the week. Where can the record of such a transaction be found? Not in the New Testament, absolutely not. In fact, Dwight L. Moody, here's what D.L. Moody said in his book, Weight and Wanting. Quote, the Sabbath was binding in Eden, and it has been in force ever since. This fourth commandment begins with the word remember, showing that the Sabbath already existed when God wrote the law on the tablets of stone at Sinai. How can men claim that this one commandment has been done away with when they will admit that the other nine are still binding? Presbyterians. This is from their theological handbook. Quote, the Sabbath is a part of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. This alone forever settles the question as to the perpetuity of the institution. Until, therefore, it can be shown that the whole moral law has been repealed, the Sabbath will stand. The teaching of Christ confirms the perpetuity of the Sabbath. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism. This is what John Wesley says. But the moral law contained in the Ten Commandments and enforced by the prophets, he, Christ, did not take away. It was not the design of his coming to revoke any part of this. This is a law which never can be broken. Every part of this law must remain in force upon all mankind and in all ages. Martin Luther. Here's what Martin Luther says. They, the Roman Catholics, refer to the Sabbath day. A shaving been changed into the Lord's day, contrary to the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, as it seems. Neither is there any example whereof they make more than concerning the changing of the Sabbath day. Great, say they, is the power of the church, since it has dispensed with one of the Ten Commandments. You see, Catholicism openly admits they changed the day. So whatever branch or denomination you come from, you cannot defend the Sabbath day changed to Sunday based on anything in the Scriptures. It's something you inherited from Roman Catholicism. Now, if you're Roman Catholic, I'm all for you. I love the Catholic people. One of the most spiritual and godly men I know is a Catholic priest. He came to our Passover Seder back in the spring. You're a wonderful man. I love Catholic people. I am not against Catholic people. I just have a problem with Catholicism itself. Because you see, in Catholicism, here's what James Cardinal Gibbons wrote. But you may read the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, you will not find a single line authorizing the sanctification of Sunday. The scriptures enforce the religious observance of Saturday, a day which we never sanctify. He openly admits the Sabbath is Saturday. We just don't do it. Because in Catholicism, they believe that through Peter, they were given the power to change the scriptures. And so they chose to change this one. Here's another quote. I've got a bunch of them. I'll give you two more. Quote, is Saturday, this is by one of the Catholic bishops, the archbishop actually, is Saturday the seventh day according to the Bible and the Ten Commandments? I answer, yes, Saturday is the seventh day. Is Sunday the first day of the week, and did the church change the seventh day, Saturday, for Sunday the first day? I answer, yes. Did Christ change the day? I answer, no. One more. This is part of the Catholic handbook. Quote, regarding the change from the observance of the Jewish Sabbath to the Christian Sunday, I wish to draw your attention to the facts. Number one, that Protestants who accept the Bible as the only rule of faith and religion should by all means go back to the observance of the Sabbath. The fact that they do not, but on the contrary, observe the Sunday stultifies them in the eyes of every thinking man. Number two, but we Catholics do not accept the Bible as the only rule of faith. Besides the Bible, we have the living church, the authority of the church as a rule to guide us. We say this church, instituted by Christ to teach and guide man through life, has the right to change the ceremonial laws of the Old Testament, and hence we accept her change of the Sabbath to Sunday. I could go on and on and on, but I won't. The Sabbath day has never changed. And it doesn't say, remember a Sabbath day to keep it holy. It says, remember the Sabbath day. And you say, well, I just don't understand. Well, that's because we're all a little dumb. We're humans. We're fallen. The thing is, God, who does understand, commands it. And if you care to understand before you obey, you'll never obey anything. You must obey before you understand. Understanding follows obedience. It's like Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Don't trust. Don't lean on your own understanding. But in all your ways acknowledge him. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him. He'll direct your paths. And I always, when I read that, I think understanding is like a wall made out of paper. You lean against it, you fall through. It will not hold you up. You let God direct your paths. You follow them. Understanding is not the locomotive. It's the caboose. It comes last. And when you walk along God's path, understanding follows. Understanding makes a terrible guide and makes a wonderful follower, because understanding allows you to see where God has brought you and to appreciate his wisdom in doing so. You will never get the Sabbath day. If you try to figure out and understand it before you do it, you'll never do it. But once you make it your practice, the world changes. Can't describe it. But I do know this. There's tremendous blessing in keeping God's Sabbath. And Rob and I have commented so many times how throughout the other 6 days of the week, so many things that could go wrong don't go wrong. It seems like striving in our lives just kind of tapers off and disappears. And then when things do go wrong, we realize this is God interrupting our day with something better, and even those things that seem to go wrong turn out to be tremendous blessings in themselves. But we find the day smooth. It's like when we keep the Sabbath, God squirts some oil into the machinery, and it hums the rest of the week. We feel like we have 8 days a week now. And I cannot describe it to you any better than that. But it is an amazing time. God has an appointment book, and he says, I set apart the seventh day to meet with my people. And I'm here. And I'll sit here for 24 hours whether you show up or not, but I'm here. And you're to seek the Lord while he may be found. I may be found from sundown Friday till sundown Saturday to have intimate fellowship with you. But you got to put everything else aside. You got to put me first. I put you first. You got to put me first. And you see, the corresponding commandment to the Sabbath day is don't bear false witness. See, here's the important thing. When you take one day a week, the Lord's Sabbath, which is totally out of sync with the world, it'd be so easy if the Sabbath was Sunday, because that's what most of the people are claiming is the Sabbath anyway, but it's not, it's Saturday, sorry. When you keep the Sabbath, and you say, forget the overtime, forget the sporting events, forget the shopping sprees, forget the get-togethers with whatever, just, I'm giving this day to the Lord. I'm going to remember it. I'm going to guard it. I'm going to keep it holy. That is a testimony to everyone around you that you don't rely on this world for your security and your provision. You're telling the whole world, yeah, I'll work the other 6 days, but this world's not so important to me that I got to work on the Sabbath, because the Sabbath is God's day. It's holy. The world keeps saying, make hay while the sun shines. You got to work, 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 work. You got to strive to make ends meet and get successful, blah, blah, blah. And you're saying, no, I trust in God for my success. My faith is in him. My security is in him. My provision's from him. Not in a paycheck, not in a job. My security is in him. And it's a fearful thing when you start to keep the Sabbath, realizing I could be working, making more money. I could be in the yard accomplishing more things. I could be doing this. I could be doing that. There's a great sale. It's only on Saturday. I'm going to miss out on the sale. But when you bless God this way, oh my goodness, does he bless you. You know, it's been said often that the Jewish people did not keep the Sabbath. The Sabbath kept the Jewish people, and it will keep us. When you violate the Sabbath day, you're telling the world, oh yeah, God's my Lord, but I can't really trust on him to meet all my needs. I got to go out and do that myself. Can't fully trust him to take a day off, his day off, and to meet with him. I challenge you. This isn't Grant Luton's teaching. This is the Word of God. If you're going to throw out the Sabbath, might as well throw out the other nine. Either it's his word or it isn't. And, of course, the fifth one and the tenth, honoring parents. The commandment reads this way. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that Adonai your God has given you. And the tenth commandment is, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. What in the world do these two have to do with each other? It's this. The very first thing a child must encounter as he begins to grasp God's sovereignty is God's choice of my parents. I didn't choose them. They didn't choose me. I remember hearing this guy talking, and his daughter's just, she's hit 16, right? She's just going nuts. Just, oh. And she's in this stage of her life where she says, well, I didn't ask for you to be born. And if you, why did you even bother having me? And he says, because we didn't know it was going to be you, you know. And I think we all go through that. But the first thing as a child begins to transition to adulthood, they must accept God's sovereignty and God's choice of my mom and my dad. And you know, every one of your parents is flawed. Some were better than others. Well, my mom wasn't. She was perfect. But Dad made up for that. So they were great people. And they were just the best. But, you know, I tell you what, when I was a young man starting to become an adult, hitting those teen years, it's like, why these two? Especially, why? You know, they're always getting in my way of fun. But a wise person told me, he says, you have to remember God chose your parents. He personally assigned them to you and you to them because it's absolutely perfect. And I just couldn't see it. It took me a long time, many years to go back and say, it was absolutely a perfect match. They needed me to learn patience, and I needed them to learn everything else. And so it's God's sovereignty. And there's a promise attached to this commandment, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord gives you. You see, the person who covets says, I don't have enough. But God says, you honor your mom and dad, I'll give you everything and a long time to enjoy it. In other words, you accept my sovereignty and you realize you'll know what to want and you'll have everything you need and I'll give you the desires of your heart. But a person who covets realizes what I have isn't sufficient, what I have is not right, it's not the right fit. I want what they have and he has and she has and that person has. And you spend your whole life chasing the wind instead of embracing God's wisdom and choice for your life. So this is a starting point. It's an amazing commandment. And notice that these commandments all have to do with the relationship with God. These commandments, 6 through 10, have to do with our relationship with people. But the one about honoring parents is over on the tablet. It has to do with our relationship with God. Because again, I think this is the first thing a child must learn in dealing with God's sovereignty. If you cannot trust God to have picked the right parents for you, then how can you trust him in anything else? You must embrace the fact those parents are assigned to you, and they may have been miserable individuals. They may have caused unbelievable pain in your life. But I think that when you can accept God's sovereignty, you will especially appreciate God's grace more than anybody. So, now do you understand why we did all this before we got to Acts 5? Let's go to one more passage. I want you to turn to Numbers chapter 15. Numbers chapter 15. Amazing story. Numbers chapter 15 is recorded there right after Israel has come up to the Jordan River. They asked to send some spies, 12 spies, over into Canaan to spy it out. After 40 days, the spies come back. Joshua and Caleb have a good report, but the other 10 have an evil report of the land. Israel breaks down, whines and cries, and then God becomes angry. And he says, okay, you sent these spies in there for 40 days, and after 40 days you decide you don't want to go in. Then for 40 years you're going to wander in the wilderness till this entire generation is dead. Because the people whine and says, oh, we go in there, our children will all die. So God says, no, tell you what, you wander around here, you're going to die, your children will go in, they'll be just fine. And then it records this incident. In Numbers 15, verses 32 to 36, while the people of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day, and those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. They put him in custody because it had not been made clear what should be done to him. And Adonai said to Moses, the man shall be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. And all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones, as Adonai commanded Moses. The sages agree that this, even though it's recorded here in Numbers, occurred 1 week after Israel arrived at Mount Sinai. They arrived at Mount Sinai and had a Sabbath rest. And the second Sabbath, this guy goes out on the Sabbath. He knew it was a Sabbath because he looked out, there's no manna on the ground. He had to know, so it couldn't be a dumb mistake. He went out willfully and decided, I need some sticks. He gathers sticks, and it cost him his life. That happened right after the very first Shavuot. Remember, it's Pentecost. Shavuot is the celebration of the giving of the Torah. God gave the Torah at Mount Sinai on the first Shavuot, and a week later, this man goes out to gather sticks on the Sabbath, and he dies. Then in Acts chapter 5, We have another Shavuot where God again appears in fire and in wind, and he speaks in other tongues through, but this time through his individual apostles. The fire, instead of on the mountain, is on them. Instead of writing the Torah on stone, he's writing it on their hearts. And then shortly after, here comes a couple, and they sell some land. They lie about how much money they got for it, and they bring a portion of the money to the apostles. You see, the man violated the fourth commandment, but Ananias and Sapphira violated the ninth. You see? The incident in Acts 5 must find its mate, and it's the incident in Numbers 15. These two come together because they comment upon one another. The man violated the Sabbath, Ananias and Sapphira, they bore false witness, they lied, and they died as well. You see the connection? I know I took a very long roundabout way to get us back to Acts 5. I hope you can see the connection here. So let's do this. Let's take a look at these two incidents, because people who are familiar with the Torah, when they read this account in Acts 5 of this couple dying shortly after a Shavuot, would have immediately thought back to the story in Exodus, the story in Numbers, which took place after that first Shavuot. Let's see what we can learn from this. Excuse me. Both events occur after Shavuot, after Pentecost. The stick gatherer violated the fourth commandment, and Ananias and Sapphira violated the ninth. The man's sin was an open sin. It was obvious. It's the Sabbath. He's out there working. Whereas Ananias and Sapphira's sin was a hidden sin. You know, the rabbis have an interesting discussion. They ask the question, okay, which is the bigger sin? To sin openly where people see you sinning, or to sin in secret where nobody sees you sinning? And their answer is basically both. One argument is this. One argument is, well, the person who sins in secret, at least he's not being a stumbling block openly to those around him. So the one who sins openly is the greater sinner. But another group of rabbis says, no. It says the one who sins in secret is showing that he fears man more than God. Because the one who sins openly, he doesn't care what you think, he doesn't care what God thinks. I'm just sitting out there in the open for everybody to see. But the one who sins in secret, he doesn't care that God sees him. He just wants you to see him. He's fearing you more than God. And they say that's the greater sin. It's interesting, isn't it, to think of it that way. The man went out and collected sticks. He had a physical desire. He wanted some heat, wanted to cook some food or whatever it was. He just had a physical need to go get some fuel, and he went out and gathered sticks. But Ananias and Sapphira, theirs was a soulish desire. They wanted to look as people who were so generous, but they actually hadn't been as generous as they wanted people to think. The stick gatherer was executed by the people, but Ananias and Sapphira were executed by God himself. He just dropped dead. The stick gatherer was just one person. But in this other sin, two people, a married couple, die. Now, with the first one, they knew that violating the Sabbath was a capital crime. The question is, what do we do? How do we go about this? And is this serious enough to actually kill the man? So Moses had to go ask God, what do I do here? Peter didn't have to ask anybody. He knew what God's will was. And he told Ananias, and then he told Sapphira, you're going to die. Boom, off they just died. Nobody had to do a thing. But Peter knew. He didn't have to ask anybody. He knew in his heart, in his spirit, what needed to be done. The stick gatherers sinned openly against God. Ananias and Sapphira sinned secretly against God. In both cases, they sinned against God. The man's error was disobedience. But Ananias and Sapphira's, theirs is much worse. Theirs was hypocrisy. Open disobedience is always preferable to hidden disobedience and hypocrisy. You know, I something struck me as I was reading the Gospels here a year or so ago, and I shared it with you, is that I never see Yeshua chewing out sinners, whether they were tax collectors, tax cheats rather, thieves, prostitutes, whatever it is. He was a friend of sinners. He spoke to them with gentleness and grace. But the one group, excuse me, that he just unleashed on were the religious leaders, the hypocrites of his day. Those are the ones. You talk about a chewing out that only a Messiah could give. That was it. You whitewashed tombs. You look good on the outside. You're full of rottenness, corruption, dead men's bones. You go chasing over land and sea to make another proselyte, make him twice the son of hell that you are. You vipers, you poisonous snakes. My goodness, and this is love speaking. You have to understand, this is love incarnate talking. Hypocrisy, much more serious sin than disobedience. The stick gatherer was carried outside the camp and then executed. But Ananias and Sapphira died, just dropped dead, and then they're carried outside and buried. What is the thing God's trying to teach us here? Why was Ananias and Sapphira's sin in some ways so much more serious? The man sinned simply because he did not have a healthy fear of God. Or he was just plain stupid. He was just rebellious and disobedient. And that's all wrong enough in its own. But Ananias and Sapphira had no fear of God whatsoever because they thought, we can sell it for this and lie and tell them we got this and give this to them, look good in their eyes, thinking God doesn't even see it. They were atheist believers. And there are plenty of those around today. There are people who believe in that Jesus is their Savior. They believe in one God. They believe he's the creator of the world, and they live their lives as atheists, as if God doesn't really see, as if God doesn't really matter. They talk about how he's sovereign, he's king, he's Lord, he's Savior, and then they live their lives as if God did not even exist because I got to do everything, because if I don't, I won't survive. So with their lips they say one thing, but with their lives they live as if God did not provide, that God did not guard. Again, it's this coming down to the Sabbath, which is our witness to the world. It is our silent witness to the world that I don't depend on this world. It's not my home, and I don't depend upon it for my sustenance. I trust in God. And Ananias and Sapphira, they kept the Sabbath, but they committed the deeper sin, the deeper thing, which is God doesn't see it all. God doesn't really do anything in my life. He's not really involved. Boy, they found out the hard way that he was. They found out the hard way that he was. These two are connected. These two stories are connected. And these two commandments are connected. There's this wonderful statement of the Talmud. All Israel are responsible for one another. And we must understand that we live our lives before him, and we live our lives before one another. It's double, it's both. And we need to make sure that we live our lives before God in fear of God, but we live our lives before one another, realizing that we are not to be a stumbling block to one another, that we are to encourage one another, that my life is lived in connection with you, that we are a body, not just a collection of body parts. We are a body. We live and depend upon one another. We're responsible for one another. We must minister to one another and allow ourselves to be ministered to by one another. We should pray for one another, look for one another's needs, encourage one another, be plugged into one another, not invade each other's privacy, not that, not get your nose in other people's business, just lift each other up. Always be letting things flow out from you to the other person, to be a giver, to be an investor in the body, because you're not in this alone. You know, some people, they want to live their life all with the body. Oh, I just love the body, love being with people, can't seem to be away from them. They don't have any walk with God. Other people claim they have this close, intimate walk with God. They just can't stand other believers. Both of those are extremes that are sin. They are wrong, and they're both extremely unhealthy. We must live and with the knowledge that God watches, he sees, and I live in fear of him that I'll disappoint him. And then we live our lives with one another, with honor, with love, with honesty, with truth. And never lose sight of those two things. The thing that really brings Ananias and Sapphira in focus for me is the fact that it's a married couple who dies here. Because everything about the stick gatherer is external. But everything about Ananias and Sapphira is internal. Because it's not on the exterior that I have an intimate relationship with God. It's in my heart. His Torah written on my heart. His Spirit dwelling in my Holy of Holies. And if you notice in Acts 5, how many times Peter says, why have you allowed Satan to fill your heart? Why did you dream this up in your heart? Why did you lie in your heart? Your heart. Your heart. Because you see, the ultimate picture of intimacy is marriage. And in this hypocrisy, we see that destroyed and dying. Because Ananias and Sapphira's marriage is a picture of our connection with God. And if we are not living in the light of the fact that he is our bridegroom and we are his bride and we are to be laying down our lives and living them, investing them, and being faithful until his return, then we're given a lie to everything we claim to stand for. What Ananias and Sapphira did looks much more innocent than this open disobedience, rebellion. But I think the word points out that what they did was much more sinister because they had a closer connection with God and they just blew it away. They didn't appreciate what had happened over the last days. Yeshua coming and dying, resurrecting the dead, ascending, God, revealing himself at that Shavuot there in the temple in Acts 2. And then they still thought, we can lie and get away with this. Too much is given, much is expected. And I tell you what, folks, we have been given an awful, awful lot. So, I'm going to leave you with that. I just want you to meditate on these things. Put these two together. And let's start trusting God more. Let's start living our lives as if he really does exist. This newsflash, he does. And being with Tim this week, realizing that in a few short days, he'll be leaving this world and standing in God's presence. I mean, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Grant, you will too. Praying in that pew this morning, sitting there thinking, I am going to stand before God. It is unavoidable. It will happen. Me and God, right there, face to face. And then I'm going to look at my life and say, uh-oh. And you will too. How you live in your life. And when God says, why didn't you trust me? Oh, I did, Lord. I accepted you as my Savior. But you never trusted me. You trust me to save your soul, but you don't trust me to provide your needs? What do you mean, Lord? Fourth commandment. It was your testimony to the whole world that you trust me. But you didn't. You thought your security came from that paycheck. You thought your security came from working in this world. You thought your security came and your fun and your joy had all come by putting my Sabbath aside and pursuing your ways. You told the whole world with your mouth you trusted me, but with your whole life you said, I can't really trust him. Can't really rely on him. We need to take this very seriously. And God has convicted me more and more over the last few months how important it is for me to keep the Sabbath holy. And in these last days, I'm commanded to encourage one another more and more and more towards good works. I encourage you, keep the Sabbath holy. You honor God, he will honor you. So how strong is your faith? That's what it comes down to. Let's not fall into the sin of the stick gatherer or of Ananias and Sapphira. God sees. God watches. We have an intimate relationship with him, but how much more intimate will it be? Or is it just a lie? Are we deceiving ourselves? I'm sure Ananias and Sapphira thought they had just a perky, fine relationship with God. But they didn't. Let's not be deceived. Those things that you may seem very small to him are very big. And those things that you seem very big to him are not that important. So let's arrange our priorities according to his word and his Torah. Then we'll do pretty good. We'll do okay. Well, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time. And I pray, Father, that we would discover the beauty of your word. We would live our lives in balanced, truthful ways. That we'd be lights in this dark world. And, Father, that we would trust you when it really counts. In very practical ways. In ways that the world will see. Not that we're trying to show them anything, but, Lord, just they'll see our lives. They'll see our good works and give glory to you, our Father in heaven. Lord, help us to trust you better. Help us not to be like the stick gatherer who is rebellious, or like Ananias and Sapphira who are simply cunning. The Lord, realize we have a God who sees and does. We thank you that you're a God who can be trusted. Help us to trust you. Make our faith strong. And may it be seen in our loving obedience, not legalistic, but loving obedience to you and your word. And we'll give you praise for all the blessings that occur. In Yeshua's name, amen. Let's stand together and bend on.